As I mentioned last month, I thought it was time to review the Sabbath day and how we are to observe it. And it's, as you know, I think you'll agree, it's good to review the basics of the teachings that God's given his people. Last time, I covered the fact that the Sabbath is not of the Jews, but it's God's Sabbath. It's God's day of rest. The Sabbath belongs to God. Last time, we went over Ezekiel 20, the chapter there, most of it, and rehearsed the history of Israel. God rehearsed it when he found them in Egypt, when he came out, when they were in the wilderness, and all things, and went from there as a whole history there. It's covered, his Sabbath is covered very shortly and briefly in Isaiah 66. We covered there, too, as a similar prophecy. Then we went to Genesis 2, 1 to 3, and saw that God blessed the seventh day. And God sanctified the seventh day. The Lord made the Sabbath day when he rested, he blessed, and he sanctified the seventh day. So we can truly say, these are my Sabbaths. You might do a Bible search sometime and put in my Sabbath, and you'll be surprised how often that pops up. We also noted that in Genesis 2, that God gave the Sabbath day by his example. He didn't rest for his benefit. He rested for our benefit. We need the rest. He doesn't. But flesh and blood certainly does need the benefit. And all the years I've been keeping the Sabbath, the first couple of years, I hadn't quite settled in yet. Now, after all these years, I look at sundown on Friday night as the end of a marathon. And even though I get the sermon the next day or whatever it is, it's kind of the Sabbath. And it's a wonderful, wonderful blessing. As we know, God came in the flesh and dwelt among us. And today I want to look a little bit at what he said about the Sabbath. Some claim that he did away with the Sabbath day. To be our Savior, of course, he had to be absolutely sinless. He could not have one sin of any kind. That means he would never break the Sabbath or any other law. He sometimes said and did things that some interpret as breaking the Sabbath, and I've seen that in various commentaries, that the Sabbath wasn't relevant. But a close review of the Gospels will show Jesus came, in part, to reform the keeping of the Sabbath. The Jews had gotten off on a wrong foot, and so he came to show them how to keep the Sabbath, how to go along that way. And let's go to Matthew chapter 5. I covered this in the last sermon on the Sabbath. I'd like to cover it again. Matthew chapter 5, verse 17. As you know, this is the beginning or near the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. And I'll cover it from the Revised Standard Version, which translates one particular word exactly as it should be translated. Matthew chapter 5, verse 17, where he said, "Think not I have come to abolish the law and the prophets." The term law and prophets was used to describe the whole Old Testament. They were the first two of the three sections, the law, the prophets, and the writings. Some call them the Psalms. And he said, "Don't think I've come to abolish the law and the prophets." And today, everybody seemed to think that's what he came for. He died for our sins, and after that, sin's okay. Huh? He paid the price for our sins, and so not at all. They got it all mixed up. "Think not that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." There are prophecies in there. There are things that have to be fulfilled, that, as we covered in previous times. And he's got to do it. He's the one who's assigned to do it. "For truly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away." Now, I'd like to point out there that this says that one day heaven and earth will pass away. They'll be replaced with a new heaven and a new earth. But until that time, till heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Everything in there is going to be accomplished. And when you realize what's in there, that's quite a mighty statement. All the prophecies about Israel coming back and dwelling in the land and the Messiah being in Jerusalem and all these things that have to happen. And there's many, many more. For I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a jot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then relaxes, and that is the proper word, whoever then relaxes the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. In the kingdom of heaven, status is taken away if you relax the commandments and teach men so that the commandments aren't so binding, shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But he who does them, the least of these commandments, technically speaking, and teaches them, shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, this is the unique Messiah formulation. Everybody else came in somebody else's name. Thus saith the Lord, so on and so forth. Here's the Lord. So he says, for I tell you. Only the Messiah can use that terminology. Unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Now that's a pretty high standard. I mentioned the word relaxes there is the proper Greek word. It's not break, but loosen. Make it less binding than God intended. In the rest of chapter 5, Jesus gave 6 examples of the religious leaders of those days doing exactly that. Weakening the commandments, weakening the instructions. But his teaching refuted those, their loosening God's law, and showed they were even more binding in the spirit. Not just the letter, but also of the Spirit. And I asked last time, and I'll ask again, what are the least of these commandments? Well, I could have a guess, but I'm not at all sure I'd be right. But I do know this. It could not be one of the Ten Commandments. One of the least of these commandments cannot be one of the ten. That God himself spoke from Mount Sinai and wrote with his own finger twice. When you put something in stone, you want to show it's as permanent in physically as it can be. But spiritual is even more permanent. The stone was for men. In the New Testament, it's going to be in the heart. Same commandments. Same change there. So he wrote it twice. The Sabbath could not be one of the least of these commandments. And even if it were, we still should do them. Let's go to Mark chapter 3. Mark chapter 3. Here's one of the places where people sometimes think Jesus was unconcerned about the Sabbath. Mark chapter 3, verse 1. These are very revealing things that are here. And it's astonishing when God's word is properly understood. It's just so enlightening and clear. Mark 3, verse 1. And he entered the synagogue again, and a man was there who had a withered hand. A man was there with a withered hand. So they watched him closely, whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. Isn't that a remarkable thing? The fact that the man's hand was withered got no sympathy from them. That it might be healed did not seem to concern them. Their only concern was to find something to accuse Jesus. Now that happens even today, where somebody's looking for something to try to nail somebody. It's very common. It's in politics all the time. Ross Perot, I think, called it gotcha journalism. This type of thing just goes on and on. And here's another thing you want to notice. They were convinced he could heal them. The question was not, could he? The question was, would he? Isn't that something? So they watched him, whether he would heal on the Sabbath. Now, they knew he was healing at other times. Oh, but if he heals on the Sabbath, he's in trouble. There's a reason why they thought that. But the fact that they already knew he could heal, but they were looking for, well, if he does it on the Sabbath, then he's breaking the law. Perhaps they'd come to the synagogue not to worship God at all. Perhaps they only came to look for something to criticize. And they're just waiting for him. The Bible has a phrase, laying in wait. Do a little Bible study on that phrase. It's instructive. The expositor's Bible commentary points out, rabbinic law allowed healing on the Sabbath only in the event that life was actually in danger. Can you imagine writing a law like that? Isn't it a bit cheeky that they decided to regulate healing? Jesus challenged them on the rabbinic law, the oral law. And he knew they were waiting for him. They ruled that in their view, healing was permitted on the Sabbath only if life was in danger. Otherwise, you shouldn't heal on the Sabbath, it's work. Now, in verses 3 and 4, Jesus challenges that thinking in a very interesting way. Mark chapter 3, verse 6. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, step forward. If I had a withered hand, I'd have stepped forward. And this man did too. And he said to them, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil? To save life or to kill? Now, he's challenging their teaching. He's challenging their teaching. I want to mention that these verses also demonstrate that you can observe the Sabbath and be totally carnal. They were very scrupulous on observing the Sabbath, but they were totally carnal. The Sabbath is a sign, but there's much more to serving God than keeping the Sabbath. Remember, Jesus said justice, mercy, faith, just as examples. Okay, he said to them, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill? But they kept silent. Now, as I said, he's challenging them on their only save life teaching. He raised the discussion to a higher level. To do good, is it right to do good on the Sabbath? Whether somebody's bad, healing, life in danger, or anything else. Was it to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill? Who was doing good about to heal the withered man's hand? Well, he was. And who was plotting murder? Of course it's lawful to restore a withered hand on the Sabbath. The idea, you say, if you're only to save life, that's human reasoning at its poorest, in my view. The Creator of the Sabbath knows how to observe it. And he said, let me read that again, 3 and 4. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, step forward. Then he said, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil? To save life or to kill? Now they said you could only heal to save life, but they were plotting murder. I mean, talk about not seeing your thinking very clearly. And when he looked around them with anger. Now, the commentaries reading it, I was surprised what they concluded. Why was he angry? And when he had looked around at them with anger, being grieved by the hardness of their hearts. They think, the commentaries think, it was because they didn't recognize him as the Messiah. I don't think that was the reason at all. I think it's because they were so uncompassionate to this poor man with a withered hand. Didn't care about him at all. He's merely a vehicle to accuse somebody. And when he looked around at them with anger, being grieved at the hardness of their heart, he said to the man, stretch out your hand. Now, in English, that's four words. I don't know what it is in Greek, but it can't be many. Four simple words in English, spoken. That's not work. Nobody can define it as work. no physical labor involved at all. Stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored as whole as the other. He did not touch it. He just said, stretch out your hand. And when he put it out there, he looked at it and see, it's fine. And his hand was restored as whole as the other. Then the Pharisees. Now we know this is Pharisees, and other verses, other parallel accounts give a little bit more information. Then the Pharisees went out and immediately plotted with the Herodians against him how they might destroy him. They didn't say, isn't it great the man's hand's healed after all these years? None of that. They got upset, they stormed out, and they got with the Herodians and plotted against him how they might destroy him. Who were the Herodians? Expositors make the point, the Pharisees, joined now by the Herodians, begin to plot Jesus' death. Although it's not clear who the Herodians were, it seems fairly certain that they were neither a religious sect nor a political party. I will go with they're not a religious sect. You wouldn't call yourself Herodians if you're religious, but I'm not so sure it's not a political party. The term probably refers to influential Jews who were friends and backers of the Herodian family. That meant, of course, Herod was appointed by Rome. That meant, of course, that they were supporters of Rome from which the Herods received their authority. They joined the Pharisees in opposition to Jesus because they feared he might be an unsettling political influence in Palestine. That's according to them. So they were the Herodians were concerned he's going to be a political force and unsettling. Again, they're not rejoicing in the man's hand at all. They're not rejoicing that someone can actually heal. Someone can actually intervene and heal. So they got with the Herodians because the Jews knew they could not go after Jesus without the help of the Roman authorities. They had to have the Roman authorities to actually carry out the situation. It's just unbelievable. Now, some people from this think that he ignored the law of the Sabbath. No, he kept it perfectly. Without fault, without any shortcoming there. Let's go back a few verses to Mark chapter 2, verses 23 to 28. Mark 2. Now it happened as he went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and as they went, his disciples began to pluck the ears of grain. They began to pluck the ears of grain. If you'd like to go back to Deuteronomy chapter 23, I'll just read it to you, but if you'd like to look at it and see it for yourself, Deuteronomy chapter 23, verses 24 and 25. Here's God giving instructions. It says, when you come into your neighbor's vineyard, you may eat your fill of grapes at your pleasure. Hey. But you shall not put any in your container. You can eat them, but you can't store them. Verse 25, when you come into your neighbor's standing grain, you may pluck the heads with your hand, but you shall not use a sickle on your neighbor's standing grain. So this was perfectly legal to go in through the fields, grab some, pop it down. But his disciples were doing this on the Sabbath. Okay, back to Mark chapter 2, verse 23. Now it happened that he went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and as they went, his disciples, and notice it doesn't seem that he did this, they did this. His disciples began to pluck the heads of grain. And the Pharisees said to him, look, why do they, not you, why do they do what is not lawful on the Sabbath? Now again, here's their view of the Sabbath. If you pick a grain on the Sabbath, you're harvesting. They were not breaking the Sabbath. They were not acting. They had 39 forbidden acts, and one of them, I think number 3, was it said no reaping on the Sabbath. You weren't to reap. They had to put in extra things on the law, and so. I always get worried when men start putting in regulations on God's law, because usually men miss the point pretty much. God's law is fine all by itself. But they were just eating according to the law, and they weren't harvesting. The fact that they didn't put them in storage means they weren't harvesting. But their man-made rule said picking grain was work, and so they condemned the disciples. Now, but he said to them, now we have to follow this, but he said to them, have you never read what David did when he was in need and hungry, he and those with him? He was in need and hungry. His disciples going through were in need and they were hungry. How he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar, and it's very interesting. We're going to read the section, and the name won't be Abiathar. And they have a lot of thought about that. How he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar, the high priest, and ate the showbread, which is not lawful to eat except for the priests. And also he gave some to those who were with him. Let's go back and we'll look at Leviticus chapter 24. Keep your finger there in Mark 2. But it's worth going back to Leviticus chapter 24 and read the law, and then we'll read something else. We'll actually read the account. Leviticus 24, verses 5 to 9. Leviticus 24, 5 to 9. And you shall take fine flour and bake 12 cakes with it. 2/10 of an ephah shall be in each cake. You shall set them in two rows, 6 in a row, on a pure gold table before the Lord. Gold covered, I understand. And you shall put pure frankincense on each row, that it may be the bread for a memorial, an offering made by fire to the Lord. Every Sabbath he shall set it in order before the Lord continually, being taken from the children of Israel by an everlasting covenant. So every Sabbath they came in with fresh loaves, and they took out the ones that were there for the week. All the offerings were unleavened, so this was unleavened bread, and it would last for a week. Every Sabbath he shall set it in order before the Lord continually, being taken from the children of Israel for an everlasting covenant. And it shall be for Aaron. After you take it away, it shall be for Aaron and his sons, that they may eat in the holy place, for it is most holy to him from the offerings of the Lord made by fire for a perpetual statute. So showbread were 12 loaves of bread were changed weekly on the Sabbath day. Now let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 21. 1 Samuel chapter 21. First Samuel 21. Now David was fleeing from Saul. Now David came to Nob and Ahimelech the priest. Now remember we said Abiathar? Abiathar is his son. This man's going to die shortly by a prophecy that was given a long time before. And I just wonder if they speculated it was going to be his son. So maybe that's, it says in the days of Abiathar, Abiathar was still alive. Those were his days, but he wasn't high priest yet. But he became high priest. So Jesus' words may have been in the time of Abiathar. And David came to Nob, to Ahimelech, the priest. And Ahimelech was afraid when he met David and said to him, why are you alone and no one is with you? So David came by himself. So David said to Ahimelech, the priest, the king has ordered me on some business and said to me, do not let anyone know anything about the business on which I send you or what I have commanded you, and I have directed my young men to such and such a place. Now, therefore, what have you on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand, or whatever can be found. And the priest answered David and said, there are no common bread on hand. Wasn't any regular loaves. But there is holy bread, if the young man have at least kept themselves from women. Then David answered the priest and said to them, truly women have been kept from us for about 3 days since I came out. And the vessels of the young man are holy, and the bread is in effect common. In other words, if it's already taken away from the altar. Then it's no longer the holy bread that it was when it was on the altar. And the bread is in effect common, even though it was consecrated in the vessel this day, earlier today. So the priest gave him holy bread, for there was no other bread there from the but the showbread, which had been taken from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away. So he was there in the Sabbath. David was hungry, he had an emergency need, and the priest gave him the bread that had been replaced. The priest saw a human need and made an exception in that instance. He did good on the Sabbath. So Jesus was pointing out they should not be critical of putting a few heads of grain in their mouth. Just back to Mark 2. But he said to them, "Have you never read what David did when he was in need and hungry? He and those with him, how he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar." Abiathar was around then, but he wasn't high priest yet. "The high priest, and ate the show bread, which is not lawful to eat except for the priests, and also gave some to those who were with him." In other words, there are emergencies, and you make exceptions. You have to use judgments in these things. I presume they had no answer to that. again, they lacked the merciful and compassionate understanding of the circumstances and judged harshly. Then verse 27. "And he said to them, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath." Now that's an important principle in keeping the Sabbath. It was made for man. That man wasn't made for the Sabbath. Well, let's ask, who made it? Obviously, it was Jesus. It was God, who had, not yet Jesus Christ, at the creation of man. He's made right on the seventh day. It seems Adam's first full day of life was a Sabbath. Adam was created on the sixth day, sometime in the sixth day. And then the Sabbath was the seventh day. And that would be his first day, first full day. Wouldn't God spend time on the first Sabbath talking with Adam? Can you imagine that conversation? Think how much Adam and Eve had to learn. They had zero experience. They had no recollection of anything. They were literally born yesterday. They had nothing in their heads. Well, unless God put something in there. So God had to explain a lot. Do you think God would explain to Adam why he was given life, and Eve, what the purpose was, what the plan was, that he would, he had a plan for them? The Sabbath was made to benefit man. It benefited the first one because he started learning why he was there. Mr. Armstrong used to say, "Why are we here?" Well, that's probably what Adam heard first. The Sabbath was made to benefit man, and to provide rest, first of all, and to focus his mind on what is holy, what is good, and also to keep humans in contact with the true God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You know, today many people think they're serving God, but they're not. he said, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do the things which I say?" We don't want to be among those who deceive ourselves into thinking we are serving God when we are not. The true God created the Sabbath for our good. It was made for man. It was made to be a blessing and a benefit, even a gift to man. And it was to guide us into the true worship of the true God. So he said to them, the Sabbath was not made for man. The Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Therefore, the conclusion of that is, the Son of Man is also Lord of the Sabbath. He calls himself the Son of Man, which meant he was the man who's going to God's going to use to deliver all the earth. And he's the Lord of the Sabbath. You know, when you say he's the Lord of the Sabbath, the commentaries have great difficulty with this, because he's the Lord of the Sabbath. They don't know what to conclude from that. They wrestle with that. They struggle with it. So I looked up the word Lord of. Lord of. And I hit 299 places, Lord of. and not all referred to God. But the most common is the one we heard about recently, the Lord of Hosts, or the Sabaoth. That accounted 247 times, the Lord of Hosts. Then he's called the Lord of Heaven and Earth. And he's called the Lord of Lords. He's also referred to as the Lord of all the earth. Regarding the gospel, he's called the Lord of the harvest. He's called the Lord of glory. He is the one who is going to bring glory and who represents it. He's called the Lord of peace. He's called the Lord of all. I once was in, when I was doing personal correspondence, there was a guy who said he wanted to serve Lord Jesus and Lord Buddha. And I pointed out to him, well, wait a minute. What is Buddha Lord of? And I went down, Lord of hosts, Lord of heaven and earth, Lord of lords, Lord of all the earth, Lord of the harvest, Lord of glory, Lord of peace, Lord of all. What else is there? Nothing. Then he reworked his thinking a little bit. He's called the Lord of the Sabbath. Now, they think, many think, that the Lord of the Sabbath can do what he wants with it. If he wants to do away with it, he can do away with it. He's Lord of the Sabbath. Well, would that pollute the Lord of hosts? He can do away with all the hosts. Would that be the Lord of heaven and earth? He can just, well, forget about it. Lord of lords, do away with all the other lords? No. The Lord of something is the one who sustains it, who's in charge of it, who is to maintain it and care for it. If you're the Lord of the manor, you look after the manor. You keep it in good shape. You take care of it. God created and sustains all that he's Lord of. The Lord of hosts, Lord of heaven, the Lord of earth, Lord of glory, Lord of harvest, the Lord of peace, Lord of all, and all, of course, includes the Sabbath. And he states specifically that he is the Lord of it. That's important for us to realize. He's the one who rested. He's the one who created it. He's the one who made it. I mentioned last time Mrs. Susan thought that these were Jewish holy days. No, they're not. God himself said at Mount Sinai, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. Historically, the children of Israel as a whole, there have been notable exceptions, but as a whole, have not cherished the Sabbath God gave them. We saw that in Exodus 20 last time. Many abandoned it. Others corrupted it by their unspiritual approach. And we don't want to fall in either ditch. We don't want to abandon it. We don't want to get unspiritual in our approach. We want to keep it the way God intended it to be kept. When you turn from the Sabbath, brethren, you turn from the true God and head down the road to destruction. I'd like you to look at Ezekiel 22. Ezekiel 22. And I'm going to take the time to go through this a little bit. And I'll be going through it from the NIV. But the wording is very similar in the New King James or whatever translation you may have. I kind of find the NIV in the Old Testament very helpful. But when you turn from the Sabbath, you turn from the true God and head down the road to destruction. And that's usually where they go wrong first. Israel was counted out two sins they got into quickly. Idolatry, which means something else before God, and Sabbath breaking. And then they went off the rail. Ezekiel 22, verse 1. The word of the Lord came to me, son of man. Interesting, he calls Ezekiel son of man. Will you judge her? Will you judge this city of bloodshed? When I hear about the news we're going through in the last few months and years, the cities of bloodshed, it's really very graphic. Then confront her with her detestable practices and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. O city that brings on herself doom by shedding blood in her midst, and defiles herself by making idols, you have become guilty because of the blood you have shed and become defiled by the idols you have made. Murder, idolatry. You have brought your days to a close, and the end of your years has come. Now, Israel, this is to the house of Israel, and they were going to be carried off the land. And it's interesting how the house of Israel is very similar today. He said, you have brought, this is in verse 4, you have brought your days to a close, and the end of your years have come. Therefore, I will make you an object of scorn to the nations, and a laughingstock to the countries. Brethren, I've lived overseas for many years, and if you could see how we look from their overseas perspective, we are becoming a laughingstock. We are becoming inept in what we do. We can't run our finances properly. We can't run a war properly. We argue and bicker and back and forth, and we tear each other down, and it's just trying to govern the country is getting almost impossible. This does not consider respect. In a spokesman's club this year, we're focusing on the subject of credibility, among other things, but credibility. America is not really credible anymore. We don't have, are not coming across as somebody who is respected. Therefore, I will make you an object of scorn to the nations and a laughingstock to all the countries. Those who are near and those who are far away will mock you, O infamous city, full of turmoil. Turmoil, turmoil, turmoil. See how each of the princes of Israel who are in you uses his power to shed blood. You aren't quite there yet, I don't think, but we're getting there. In you, and you'll see this is something he uses here, in you, they have treated the father and mother with contempt. In you, they have oppressed the alien and mistreated the fatherless and the widow. You have despised my holy things and desecrated my Sabbaths. It's another one of those my Sabbaths. In you are slanderous men bent on shedding blood. Now, especially if you look at the spirit of the law from the New Testament point of view, all this hate and criticism and accusation and all this, this is murder in God's sight. Verse 9, in you are slanderous men bent on shedding blood. In you are those who eat at the mountain shrines and commit lewd acts. The mountains were the pagan gods. In you are those who dishonor their father's bed. In you are those who violate women during their period when they are ceremonially unclean. They couldn't go into the temple at that time. That's all that means. In you, one man commits a detestable offense with his neighbor's wife. Another shamefully defiles his daughter-in-law. And another violates his sister, his own father's daughter. In you, men accept bribes to shed blood. You take usury and excessive interest and make unjust gain from your neighbors by extortion. And you have forgotten me, declares the sovereign Lord. I will surely strike my hands together at the unjust gain you have made and at the blood you have shed in your midst. Will your courage endure or your hands be strong in the day I deal with you? I, the Lord, have spoken, and I will do it. I will disperse you among the nations and scatter you through the countries, and I will put an end to your uncleanness. Verse 16, when you have been defiled in the eyes of the nations, you will know that I am the Lord. That's very strong. But notice a little further down the chapter, beginning in verse 23. Ezekiel 22, verses 23 to 31. Again, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, say to the land, you are a land that has had no rain or showers in the day of wrath. In days, God promised that he would start withholding the rain, and he'd hold it back. We're all kind of glad we didn't get too much snow, but I don't know that Lake Michigan is, that it's low when it needs water. Now, maybe it'll all flow in from Wisconsin. They got more snow, but there's obviously very little. You are a land that has no rain or showers in the day of wrath. There is a conspiracy of her princes. The NIV has princes. The New King James says prophets within her. There's a conspiracy within her like a roaring lion tearing its prey. They devour people, take treasures and precious things, and make many widows within her. You know, it's interesting. Our government is running out of money. Our government leaders are not. They're all getting wealthy. Mr. Armstrong observed years ago, he said, I don't know how it works, but when somebody gets into the Senate, from there on, they're wealthy. He says, I'm not saying that there's anything going on here, but it is a strange phenomenon that all of a sudden they're very prosperous. When your steward is getting prosperous and the employer is going broke, something's wrong. Very wrong. Okay. There is a conspiracy of her princes within her, like a roaring lion tearing its prey. They devour people, take treasures and precious things, and make many widows within her. Her priests, he goes down these categories, princes, now priests. Her priests do violence to my law and profane my holy things. Did you see that in the time of Christ? They're criticizing him for healing a man or for eating a few grains. Her priests do violence to my law and profane my holy things. Profane is the opposite of holy. Holy means special high standard of God. Profane means common, everyday. They profane my holy things. They do not distinguish between the holy and the common. They teach that there's no difference between the unclean and the clean. I grew up thinking, you know, there's no difference between the clean and the unclean. Nobody taught me clean meats or unclean meats and other things as well. Conduct. Meats come to mind first, but that's not the only thing. But God's priests are supposed to teach this is clean and this is unclean. This is holy and this is profane. They're supposed to make that distinction. They didn't. Halfway through verse 20, well, let's go to 26. Her priests do violence to my law and profane my holy things. They do not distinguish between the holy and the common. They teach there's no difference between the unclean and the clean. And they shut their eyes to keeping of my Sabbath. They deliberately won't look at it. You know, to me, it's simple, Sabbath, because can you imagine God has 10 commandments, he has them there on the mountain, and he made it a creation, gave it to Israel, kept all the way down the line, and comes the New Testament and said, well, forget about it. It just makes no sense. That's not how God is. His word is truth. And the truth is, the Sabbath is the seventh day, which he made a creation. It said, so they shut their eyes to the keeping of my Sabbath. People don't want to see it. I remember that because I didn't want to see it. God started calling me, I don't want to keep the Sabbath. I don't want to do that. I said, ran the other way for a time, thankfully unsuccessfully, so that I am profaned among them. When you don't keep the Sabbath, you don't know God, and you got a whole wrong idea who God is and what his ways are. Then he says in verse 27, her officials, now he talked about her princes, her priests, and now her officials within her are like wolves tearing the prey. They shed blood and kill people to make unjust gain. We just heard about LIBOR and all that, and it's getting bigger and bigger as it keeps growing. And we're hearing about all these things that are corrupt in our society, where the people have cheated, inside trading. We're hearing it all the time. It's becoming increasingly corrupt. Her officials within her are like wolves tearing their prey. They shed blood and they kill people to make unjust gain. Her prophets whitewash those deeds for them. By false visions and lying divinations. Her prophets don't tell the truth. And they whitewash those deeds for them by false visions and lying divinations. They say, this is what the sovereign Lord says, when the Lord has not spoken. Now, the last category he covers are the rest of us. He talked about her princes, her priests, officials, her Sabbath, her prophets, and now the people of the land practice extortion and commit robbery. They oppress the poor and needy and mistreat the alien, denying them justice. It isn't just the leaders, it's the people too who do the same thing. And God says in verse 30, I look for a man among them who would build up the wall and stand before me in the gap on behalf of the land so that I would not have to destroy it. But I found none. Now, apparently Ezekiel didn't quite qualify because he was the prophet, but he's just to announce to the people. But he looked for a leader back then when Israel was going through all this, and he didn't find one. And it looks like it's going to be the same today. Verse 31, so I will pour out my wrath on them and consume them with my fiery anger, bringing down on their own heads all they have done, declares the sovereign Lord. It's a mighty thing. When you go away from the Sabbath, you go away from God. When you go away from serving God, you go into some kind of idol. There's all kinds of idols. Everything else people serve is an idol. Now, in future, I intend to give more understanding, more teaching on God's Sabbath. I know you want to hold these truths we've been given, and we never want to let them go. Today, I wanted to bring to your attention the fact that God says the Sabbath belongs to Him. It's one of His good and perfect gifts from above. One of the good and perfect gifts. Even the enemies. There was a man who was a Seventh-day Adventist minister. He turned away from the Sabbath, and in his name was Brinsmead. And in the book, in his writing, he says, "But I have to admit, those people that keep the Sabbath, their families are great. They're together. But he starts railing against the Sabbath. But he said the fruits of Sabbath keeping are good." Strange. As I said, it's one of God's good and perfect gifts from above. Let's be certain that we remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, because He created it for our good.